High Liberty, Chapter 4. He had long since completed the last copy of the latest draft of his final excerpt of the Laws and Procedures of Jactictation. It lay under his hand, reduced to 2 neat sheets. He touched it lightly as he sat watching the sleeper, or watching the world and all life, with his eyes ready to watch the sleeper when it was time. What a strange old man, ugly and gruff, gentle, repulsive, brilliant, mad. He wondered if he had ever stopped before to take the measure of Simon Barrowbridge. He thought not. He had set foot on that creaking board by the door for the first time when he was still in his 11th year. He had reached for the coachman's hand numbly, and held to it as if he were dangling from a tree limb 40 feet up. Barrowbridge had seemed wide as a summer cloud, distant as majesty. Old Piggott had doffed his hat and scuffed his boot and said, "Here he is, sir," as if he had spoken of him to the barrister before, and indeed he must have. "Ah," the monster had snorted, looking him up and down, "what's he got to smile about, the little basilisk?" Lanky had not remembered smiling. Only the terror and the black future forever. He would see Piggott again in 2 hours, but the coachman's parting was almost more than he could bear. He'd have run, but he was rooted. He could not even turn away once he was alone with Barrowbridge. All he could recall now was that endless paralysis while the man just stared at him. The great pocked chin, a pucker with derision, the slight contraction about the eyes that might have grown to scornful merriment if he had been significant enough, and afterwards, "Sweep, sweat, and swat," he murmured now, wagging his head in amazement. What a wringing out! What a starching he'd had those years! If Barrowbridge had not torn off an arm and a leg and tacked them back on in the wrong places, it was only because he had not thought of it. Heaven knows he altered everything else. Every move, every thought, every syllable he produced were regarded as Barrowbridge property, to be moulded by the Barrowbridge hand. The boy had lived in terror of his ubiquitous cudgel. Even then it was becoming difficult for him to move about, and he was marvellously dexterous with a stick. Flicking down a book from the shelves, hooking a dish of cold tea across the desk, deftly scratching this or that otherwise inaccessible part of his immense person. Time and again he heard it whistling down on him, only to tug at the hem of his smock as it passed close by. Now he knew what he could not have then. Simon Barrowbridge struck no blows with his weapon, save for the single time Lanky had been set upon by street toughs just outside. 4 against 1. And the old chap had come lumbering and wincing down the street. That was the time to make up for all others. With his baited bull roaring, thunder on thunder like a king's cannonade, and for each bellow a thwack and a yell from the enemy, until the noise was fit to move the shops back and widen the road, and the erstwhile attackers milled about, smarting so in their backs and shoulders that they didn't know which way to run, and howled around, bumping into one another, until the giant tired of the sport, and showed them the way with a last hearty flurry. He had said a strange thing just then, panting and watching the street boys fly away bawling. "A heady thing to know you're right. It seldom comes." He crammed his slave with Greek and Latin, as he crammed himself with the suety pasties which had now brought him down, and his gospel was the Oracula of Balthasar Gracian. 5,000 times he must have said, "Live by the Gracian, but as you live, quote him not, for these 4 things will damn him in the modern world." And the 4 fat fingers would count them down. "Gracian's a Jesuit and a Papist, Gracian's a Spaniard, Gracian's barely 100 years dead, and Gracian's something you know and the other chap does not, for which you would never be forgiven." So while his contemporaries were learning homiletics, lofty, inapplicable, unattainable, Lancaster Higger Pigott was marinated by Gracian, who said, "There is always time to add a word, never to withdraw one. Talk as if you were making your will. The fewer the words, the less litigation." And who said, "Never from sympathy with an unfortunate involve yourself in his fate." And, "The wise do at once what the fool does at last. To command is merely to force men to do what they might do of their own accord." And most often from the lips of Simon Barrowbridge was this: "You must learn to put up with fools." Surly, sloppy Barrowbridge instilled in his student a macaroni's urge for display and a Gregorian's austerity, and kept him in the tight balance between. "Take half the ribbons off that hat and make the others dark," he taught him, one brandy from another, and not to ask for either at the ale drinker's table. "The woman was never born who hasn't a beauty about her. You must find it in an instant and tell her. But stay within reason. If she's as tall as your collar, don't stand there admiring upward. You may act like a fool, boy," he had once told him. "Any time you know, you're just acting." Barrowbridge's practice was a rich one, but in variety only. A barrister needs to know the law. Abiding by it is quite another specialty. He could not afford the luxuries of defending only the innocent and supporting only the weak. As the years passed and he became less and less able to travel, his work became more and more advisory, and his purse thinner. The best of advice in the hands of the ignorant and the slipshod is worth nothing, and nothing was what he frequently got through the mistakes of others. But in the eyes of the apprentice, much of this was priceless. He would crouch over his tall table and sponge up the sounds of what crossed the master's desk, hearing the probes of legalistics penetrating the fabric of law, hearing how courts common could be brought counter to courts Christian, how cases could be made to fail in the certainty they would be reversed on appeal. He saw many a groat gained through mad demands for a sixpence, and many a fleeced lamb gamboling with such joy that it did not realize it had lost something. He listened amazed to friends here who were enemies in the legal arena, and their strivings to prolong where the fees were high, and to bring justice swiftly where they were low. "You're not to be a barrister," Barrowbridge told Lance when he was 18. It was not a prophecy, it was a command. "You're to be a gentleman. The law's for Oxonian sort of chaps who've studied a third as well for twice as long as you have. They've all the chits and certs and thank you dean sort of recommendations, and whether they stand for Parliament or whether they take up the land holdings, it does not matter to you. You'd never compete with their kind. You could not. They have a curl of the lip way of chatting with people like you who frighten them. I say, old man," he mimicked, "where did you go to school?" "A gentleman does not ask such a thing of you, nor does he inquire of your fortune and family. If he is a gentleman, he accepts you. But to be so accepted, you must be more perfectly a gentleman than an advocate at the bar must perfectly be an advocate. Do you follow me?" The matter of a Courtney, Earl of Devon, was the product and discovery of Barrowbridge's capacious mind and references. "Given your ancestry, at present unknown, you have taken the first great step toward finding one. To make a Courtney out of a Smith, one must first have to erase his Smithness. You have nothing to erase. So you do not at present have this difficulty." So Lance swept and sweated and swatted. In manor houses in Surrey, Hampshire, and Berks, he watched the gentry secretly from pantry and stable. He shot black cock and grey hen with gamekeepers, whose masters were in the city, and played billiards with city footmen, whose masters were shooting grouse. Whether Coachman Pigott had not acquaintance and entry into the world of backstairs, Barrowbridge could obtain it at the front door with some young blood, say, whose angry tailor had been placated or counter-threatened, or from some lady whose carelessness had produced results which Barrowbridge had healed. Another youth lounging about was never remarkable. Village folk would think he belonged to the manor, and the manor staff thought he might be from the village. As to his wide familiarity with houses in town, the gentry never knew. The times were right for such a machination, and the place. It was in the wake of the Seven Years' War, a boiling, uncertain, exhilarated, impoverished, expanding time, wherein England was acquiring its empire, merchant baronets were beginning to appear in the house, great estates were growing greater, or smaller, or changing hands. It was a time of comings and goings, of new faces at Milady's soiree, and strange faces at the London hostels. Bouillon and Calais were handier to the city than Wiltshire and Berks, and young Lance Courtney was by no means the only person in England who was substituting courtliness and fine linen for a pedigree. Barrowbridge stirred, and Lance rose instantly to put the kettle on. It was growing dark. He lit a candle and carried it into the bedroom. In the silent way of the sick and the old, Barrowbridge was altogether awake on the instant, watching him. "How are you, sir?"
"I am a dead man."
He raised his head weakly to look into the other room and let it fall again. Lance correctly read his wistful hunger.
"I've put the kettle on for you." He straightened the pillow. "You're no more dead than I am."
"I am. I died there on the floor when ye watched me grovelling."
He looked up at Lance's contemplative face.
"Would you be going ahead with this amusement now, lad, if you planned to change your plans? Mutilating a corpse is not conduct becoming to a gentleman below the rank of Viscount."
"I'll not harm you, sir," Lance said gently.
Barrowbridge grunted and closed his eyes. Though his hands did not move, Lance had the impression he was feeling over his aching body, like a man after a bad fall taking tender inventory.
"By God," he said in his harsh whisper, "I might have laughed at anything from a hot poker to the Iron Maiden, and even borne the bursting of my bowel from the ordeal of the pot you devised. But you had me grovelling. Aye, and that without laying a hand on me, without speaking any but respectful words."
He wasn't angry. He was examining the events of the morning with an almost admiring detachment.
"God, the wrong parents made me look like a Barbary ape, Lanky. But 'tis I alone who have made a beast of myself. Only two people on earth have made a fool of Simon Barrowbridge, and you're the second. Working, I gather," he added, eyes abruptly open and blazing, "for the first."
"Ah, sir, you said that before, and I remarked that you did me little credit. I was instructed by no one."
"All your own ideas, eh? You'll pardon the curiosity of a disembodied spirit, because I insist I'm dead. 'Tis the only way I can live with myself now. But if 'twas information you wanted, even to succour mine enemies, why need the request take the form of torture, boy? Or have you been concealing the appetites of that villainous marquis they've been gossiping about these days?"
"May I return your question with a question, sir?"
"Why, that would be in the best tradition of a barrister."
"Thank you, sir. Well, then, is it true that you had vowed never to assist Elizabeth Chudleigh in any circumstance?"
"While I lived," the old man nodded, "further proof of my passing, if any were needed, but go on."
Then can you think of any way I might have secured this information from you but by doing what I did? Might I have simply asked you and given my simple reason, or threatened you with that hot poker you have only now derided, or reasoned with you, or argued?
I concede your points, especially the last. And what put that especial method into your surprising young mind?
Lance smiled in his turn. Our old comrade in worldliness, Balthazar Gracian, where he counsels, find out each man's thumbscrew. 'Tis the art of setting their wills in action.
What a viper I have raised in my nest!
Cried Barrowbridge, and now there was no concealing his rueful admiration.
And have you found your precious information?
In answer, Lance went for his summary of the procedure of jactation, and brought it to the bed, and put a second pillow under the barrister's shoulders, adjusting the candle, and then left him to brew the tea.
Well drawn,
said Barrowbridge when he returned. A moment later, with teapot, sugar, and cup, he waved the papers about.
And to what end are you giving away this rare gem?
To right the injustice of Miss Chudley's situation, said Lance pompously. Anne enjoyed the amazement which grew on the other's face, and enjoyed even more the glee which replaced it when he added,
And I'm too much your disciple to be giving anything away.
The tea was poured by now. He took it and sipped with noisy gratification.
Now then,
he murmured as he sipped and pondered, and again,
Now!
Sure outward sign of his mighty-minded work, Lance stood by silently, waiting.
In my shriven state, as I lie here dead and released from the pettiness and paucity of a man's lot on earth, it comes to me that my long bitterness toward that lady is unworthy. Notice, lad, I don't say unjustified, never that, but the truth of my rancor and its long tenure, those are unworthy. True to the code of a gentleman, you have not asked me the cause of this, well, disaffection of mine in regard to the lady. True to the instincts of a soul in purgatory, I shall tell you. It is a sad tale and reflects little credit on any one concerned, but then it's a confession, and well do you, my executioner. In addition, you have set yourself a perilous course through the very heart of a jungle of which you have as yet traversed only the margins.
But, sir, I—
Hush! Listen! The barrister snapped. I am writhing in embarrassment and chagrin at the very contemplation of an episode I have concealed even from myself for 20 years. You have reduced me to a prideless fraction of my former self, and I very much doubt I shall ever have the fortitude to begin this tale again.
Lance ostentatiously placed both hands tight over his mouth and sat down to listen.
I said 20 years, he began, and I couldn't be more precise. It was 1749, just this early in the year, and now that I think on it, as unseasonably warm. I'd wintered well in Majorca. This was before Admiral Byng gave it away to the French, and it was pleasant and peaceful, and the task I had there pleased me, and was successful. I'll not add it to my story just now, because it was skullduggery, because it does not concern the matter at hand, and because I won't spoil the telling of it one day when it is germane. You should know only that the law was but a piece of my career in the early days. I performed what one might call confidential repair work on broken things, vows, hearts, contracts, consciences. I returned to England, pleased with myself, settled with my tailor for the first time in 12 years, and took a little house in Jermyn Street. I shall not say I had a reputation for efficiency, because a reputation implies wide public knowledge, and an element in my efficiency was the very absence of renown. For handling of matters such as the return of embarrassing letters or the gathering of evidence to transform potential to putative paternity, one does not insert a public notice in the monthly review. Don't raise your eyebrows at me, lad. My standards were high. I never undertook an assignment not in the interests of justice, though I'll confess to use of my client's definition of the word. Where were we? High standards. Yes. I had a bit of capital, you see. My health and a bit of leisure, so I could pick and choose. I accepted only those assignments which I could positively fulfill. Clients who were turned away went elsewhere and forgot me. Clients whom I served were satisfied and sent me to others. As a result, I actually was known for a certain period as a man who made no errors. My promise was as good as anyone's oath, and because I succeeded in everything I undertook, many believed I would succeed in anything I undertook. And perhaps I had begun to believe that as well, else I should have excused myself from my drawing-room the instant Elizabeth Chudley entered. But I did not, and I was undone. No, I am shriving myself. Prosperity was my undoing quite as much, or I might have demanded a more negotiable fee than the one I extracted. Complacency was my undoing, for I had ample warning that Miss Chudley was not to be dealt with as any other client, and perhaps the old Adam undid me most of all. I wish you could have seen her then. They tell me she is still a splendid-looking woman, but in those days, imagine first her clothing, a bottle-green gown with a little cape, a strange hat close to the brow and flaring out behind to frame her face with a darker green than the dress, almost black. Now in my time I have observed many an artifice for the entrapment of the unwary, and have devised not a few myself. I yield the palm of to few men, but with all my heart to any woman I do. They come by it untaught, and reach excellence by instinct. Like a green shoot, they'll break rocks to accomplish it, however tender they be. A long time had passed since the scandalous episode of the costume ball at the Venetian embassy, 5 years at least, and she had used them as well as they had her. Then she made such an extreme of forwardness that it looked like innocence. Here in my drawing-room she was so modest in appearance, so decorous in mien, so foiled in gentility, that the whore in her flamed out like a diamond. She had a flawlessness about her, skin that mud wouldn't stick to, and a child's mouth and arches to her brows barely turned, like the flat, steady wings of birds that soar. But I don't want to tell you she was a beautiful woman. Well, perhaps she was, but if she was, no beautiful woman had ever looked like her before. Her lips said what she wished them to say. Her eyes demanded openly to know what a man had, and how soon he intended to use it. Ah, and I was a shade under 40, and I had my health, and I had my health. She paid me the compliment of taking no precautions, exacting no confidence, telling no lies. She made it clear by those omissions that she knew who I was. I knew who she was, and that being what we both were, we could work together, or we could not, once the facts were out. She told me as soon as I had seated her she was married to young Augustus John Hervey, brother to the second Earl of Bristol, that the marriage had been secret and unsatisfactory, and that they had been living apart for nearly 5 years. Nonetheless, recent news from Ickworth in Suffolk had given her something to think on. It seemed that George Henry Hervey, the Earl, lay even now in Ickworth, aflame with fever and his life was feared for. Should he be taken, her husband would inherit the title and the estates. Married, she would be countess, and either remain one, or draw off a reasonable weight of Bristol treasure as the price of a divorce or annulment. But of her marriage to this young gentleman, there was no record. The curate who had done the thing had taken a large contribution for his little church in exchange for a lapse of memory. He was now dead, as was the village idiot who had witnessed the midnight ceremony. Probably 1,000 people knew of this wedding. 50,000 had guessed. No living soul except the principals could swear they saw it done, and one of them might not. Could this marriage, valid in the sight of God, the church, and common law, be entered quietly in the parish records? I asked her where and exactly when the marriage had taken place, and then I thought a bit, while she waited with her face asleep and eyes alive. Presently I asked her what she would do if the Earl recovered. He was, after all, only 3 years older than his brother, and thereafter outlived Methuselah. You see, I had known for some time that this remarkable creature was the mistress of the Duke of Kingston. The future cannot be foretold, I said to her, but in a measure it can be controlled. One may eliminate things from it, as one can never do with the past. Might it not be possible that one day she would regret the existence of a written record? I think that troubled her, but only for a moment, for she smiled at me. It must have been then I decided to make a fool of myself. Rather, say, to permit her to do so. She smiled and said, I understand you can repair anything, any time, if the price is right. If one day I needed to rid myself of this evidence again, might you manage it? For the only circumstance I can imagine would make that desirable would entail a sizable advancement. And I knew she was thinking, even then, of one day being Duchess of Kingston, though her hopes were not great. I said no. The evidence must stand, once in. Getting it out again would be a mutilation too difficult to conceal. On the other hand, I said, I had run across some surprising information which would apply to that circumstance. Now that's all I said about it, and it was true. She believed me, and she believes to this day that I know a way to erase that irritating union with Augustus Hervey, who, by the way, has still not inherited, and is still an officer in His Majesty's Navy, as he was the day she met him, though rather higher up. In any case, she tottered up the wrists in an instant, and then laughed. She has a shrewdness which surpasses intelligence, and an intuition which is wiser than wisdom. I must have the Hervey marriage just now, she said, and I might like another later. Let us be dutiful, then, and do what we must. Later, when the circumstances arise, we can consider the other. Very well, I told her. I'll rush off to your little lost village and see that your lost marriage is recorded. There's only one more thing to discuss, and I'm off, praying the good Earl lives the week out. I shouldn't like him to predecease our plans. One more thing, she says. Oh, and of course the fee. The fee. I looked at her until even she must drop her eyes. Will it be much, she asked me, and for reasons I cannot clearly explain, that with the most hilarious thing I had ever heard. I came out with a big, inexcusable boom of laughter. I told her I could not possibly answer such a question. And then, like a fool, I laughed again. I do not think women enjoy being laughed at. When I could, I said, "You have the payment with you this minute, Miss Chudley." She stood up. She understood immediately and completely, and said without hesitation, "Very well, then. Have you a preference as to the time of payment and the place?" "I have," I said, "but I will gladly accept yours." She inclined her head politely, and I know she hated me with all of her heart, but smooth as butter she promised. "Within a week after the task is done, on grounds I shall choose, without witnesses, of course." There seemed to be nothing to say to that. I opened the door to show her out. She glided through, and in the foyer, with her back to me and her body unmoving, said softly, "Just once." I said, "Why, of course, m'lady, just once." Then she bowed her head and left my house.